So he's on the bed. He's trying to fall asleep. He's a little boy, can't really fall asleep because his father is sitting in the room teaching Torah to a couple of students who are gathered around.
Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik straddled different worlds. Born into a dynasty of great rabbinic scholars, Rabbi Soloveitchik's horizons were shaped by Jewish learning and masterful Talmudic erudition. He also threw himself into the world of Western philosophy, earning a doctoral degree from the University of Berlin and pursuing philosophical interests throughout the rest of his life. Born at the dawn of the 20th century in the outskirts of the Russian Empire, Rabbi Soloveitchik moved to America, where he revolutionized Jewish education, founded the Maimonides School in Boston, and was for decades the beating heart of Yeshiva University's mission to pursue Torah wisdom alongside secular knowledge. Along the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik became the 20th century's most important American Orthodox writer and thinker. We will learn about Rabbi Soloveitchik's description of the existential dilemmas of the human condition, the meaning of prayer and repentance, how Rabbi Soloveitchik thought about the Jewish family and Jewish community, Zionism in the State of Israel, Jewish-Christian relations, and the calling of Jewish leadership in the modern age. Rabbi Soloveitchik, known reverently as the Rav, articulated a vision of the modern Jew who lives the tension between faithful obedience to the inherited way of life that sustained the Jewish people from generation to generation, and at the same time, who proudly engages the fullness of the modern world. Our teacher is Dr. Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, University Professor of Jewish History and Jewish Thought, and Senior Scholar at the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. Alongside his many published books, essays, and articles as a scholar, Rabbi Schachter has also served as the Dean of the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Institute in Boston, and as the Rabbi of the Jewish Center in New York City. In this course, Rabbi Schachter will guide us through the major elements of the majesty and humility of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life, leadership, and legacy. In this first lecture, you are going to speak some about how you first encountered Rabbi Soloveitchik, how you first met him. But I wonder if you can give us any more detail about how he influenced you and your family, just as we get ready to study his work in detail throughout this course.
Rabbi Soloveitchik had an incredible influence on me and my family. My father was a student of his. Not directly, but actually indirectly. My father studied with his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, and was ready to get rabbinic ordination at what later became Yeshiva University when Rabbi Soloveitchik Sr. passed away. And there was a whole lineup of boys who were ready and waiting to get ordination, and my father was the first one in. And so for us and our family, this connection with Rabbi Soloveitchik was extremely precious. My father was very proud. And he had a lifelong close relationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik. My father became a very prominent American Jewish leader and consulted Rabbi Soloveitchik on a regular basis. My father was the president of the Religious Zionists of America. Rabbi Soloveitchik was the honorary president of the Religious Zionists of America. My father was very close to both him and also to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and in 1980 historically brought the two of them together when he brought Rabbi Soloveitchik to Brooklyn to sit in on and participate in what's called a Fabrengen. It's an opportunity where the Lubavitcher Rebbe presented a lot of his thinking and a lot of his Torah thoughts. And it was an electric moment when Rabbi Soloveitchik came into this huge, massive room filled to capacity. And for the first time ever, the Lubavitcher Rebbe stood up. And you can only imagine that when he stood up, 5,000 people stood up, shot up.
What are we going to see in this lecture?
I'm a historian, and for me, life stories are important. Biographies are important. It's the stuff of history. There's actually a debate among historians and among intellectuals in general, what is the stuff of history? Is it focused on individuals who play a role and then everything else revolves around them? Or are there certain factors or perspectives or a certain unfolding of narratives that happen and individuals play a significant role? But which comes first? Is it the context and then the individual moves into a particular context, or does the individual, is he the one or she the one who moves the context? But in either case, the life story is important. But in this case, it's biography not just for the sake of biography, and life not just for the sake of life, but it's life for the sake of ideas. And what we will be looking at in the first presentation is a presentation of the life of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and embedding within that presentation as the life unfolds, moments where specific issues that we will engage in the remaining lectures play themselves out. Where is he first exposed to issues of the relationship between Judaism and general culture that was so important to him? Where is he first exposed to issues about Zionism? Where is he first exposed to issues about the Christian-Jewish relations? Where is he first exposed to being a leader and taking public positions? So the goal of the first lecture is to present a scaffolding into which we will place the beginnings, the origins of the various intellectual foci of Rabbi Soloveitchik as they will occur throughout the course of his life and throughout the course of the remaining presentations. I will never forget the first time that I encountered Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I was 6 years old. I was living in the Bronx in New York City with my parents next to a major hospital in the area that is known as Montefiore Hospital. My parents often visited patients there and often took me along. One evening, I'm walking with my father into the lobby of Montefiore Hospital, and coming towards us was a very tall man. I was 6 years old. I was always short. I was for sure short when I was 6 years old. Very tall man surrounded by a large group of people. My father looks at him and says to me excitedly, "That's the Rav, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik." My father enjoyed a very close and warm relationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'll come back to that shortly. He greeted him and he introduced me to him. And then Rabbi Soloveitchik leaned over and he patted me on my cheek. At that moment, one of the rabbis walking with him leaned over and said to me, "Don't wash your face for a week." Don't wash your face for a week. I was 6 years old, and all I knew was that every night my mother said to me, "Please make sure to wash your face." And here there's an adult and a rabbi telling me not to wash my face for an entire week. From then on, this man named Rabbi Soloveitchik became a very significant figure in my life. I heard his name mentioned very often in my parental home with great, great reverence. He officiated at my wedding when I was married at my father's request. When I was living in Boston in the 1970s as a graduate student at Harvard University studying with his older son-in-law, Professor Tversky, I would attend his Saturday night lectures and his Sunday morning Talmud classes all the time. I asked him my personal questions in Jewish law, many of them. I remember one in particular when my wife was pregnant. She was about to give birth. One Sunday morning, I said, "Rebbe, what do we do if we have to go to the hospital on the Sabbath? How do you maneuver all the laws, the complexity of trying to get in a car, in a taxi, to the hospital on a Sabbath?" When I served as a rabbi in a small town outside of Boston, I asked him all of my communal questions that arose. In my formative years, Rabbi Soloveitchik represented for me what I wanted to be when I grew up: a deeply learned and highly respected Jewish leader whose written and oral teachings inspired
and educated vast numbers of Jews. I wanted it, even though I felt, and I actually knew, that never, ever would I be able even to remotely attain his level of achievement. All of this I present by way of background to indicate that the inquiry that we now begin to undertake together is not without great personal relevance and resonance for me. I owe an enormous amount to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, personally. Having said that, I will proceed, I hope and I expect, with fairness and objectivity, and hope to present the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik as fairly, as objectively, as honestly, and as accurately as I can. The challenge before us is a formidable one. First, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote and taught about many different subjects. His work, both oral and written, is rich and multifaceted and wide-ranging. His ideas and his teachings have generated great interest and have spawned a growing secondary literature. It will be impossible for me in the course of the next 8-7 presentations to discuss all of the areas that he addressed in the course of his work. Furthermore, it's not only the amount of material that is daunting, but also the quality of the material. Some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's ideas and formulations are objectively difficult to understand, and as a result have been the subject of much debate, featuring varying and sometimes opposite interpretations. I myself have difficulty understanding some aspects of his thought, especially the technical philosophical parts, and I am therefore unable to present them to you properly and effectively. And therefore, I will be unable to do justice to the fullness and the complexity of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, but I will try to do the best I can. I want now, in this first unit, to begin with the life story of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I do so not only to provide a general sense of when he lived and where he lived, who were the major influences on his life. Obviously, that's important when one analyzes the thought of any figure. But because by doing so, it will give me an opportunity to root his thought, the focus of the next 7 presentations, in a particular time and place, to show when and why all of the issues that I will be addressing over the remainder of this seminar became important to him. One can never separate the life's experiences of an individual from her or his thought, and it is particularly true in the case of Rabbi Soloveitchik. The point becomes already obvious when thinking about and talking about his parents. Rabbi Soloveitchik descended on his father's side from probably the most distinguished family in the world of Lithuanian Torah scholarship aristocracy of the 19th century. His great-grandfather, after whom he was named, Rabbi Joseph Baer or Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, known more popularly as Rabbi Chaim of Brisk, after the town that he spent formative years of his life in, with which he is most identified. Both of them were highly influential communal leaders and giants, massive giants of Torah scholarship, both of whom enjoyed international reputations. Reb Chaim in particular had a very strong personal influence on our Rabbi Soloveitchik. He died when Rabbi Soloveitchik was 15 years old, and our Rabbi Soloveitchik spent formative years, important experiences that he had with his grandfather that he refers to on a regular basis. And Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, the father's father, represented a clear ideology that I am going to refer for the course of our discussion as a Torah-only ideology. That means that only Torah has value, nothing else has value at all. Anything other than pure Torah study was deemed to be a waste of time and could not at all, under any circumstances, be justified. Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother was a Feinstein. Her father, Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, was the rabbi of a small Polish town of Prusjana, or of Prusjin. And while he also was a formidable Torah scholar in his own right, he was more open to and appreciative of the general world in which he lived. He raised his daughter Pesia, Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother, to appreciate not only a traditional Torah learning and living, but also the importance of world literature, the importance of current events. He represented an ideology that I will call, for the sake of our discussion, a Torah and ideology. Torah, of course, first and foremost, but Torah and other important aspects, valuable sources of knowledge outside of Torah that were also respected. Rabbi Soloveitchik's parents were married in 1901, and as was the practice at that time, the young groom moves into the in-law's house, and the in-laws supported them. He moves from Brisk to Prusjin, and immediately there's trouble. He was unhappy with what he found in his new bride and her parents' home. Alongside the words of Torah that were discussed at the Sabbath table, the works of Tolstoy, Russian literature, were also discussed. This was very strange and disturbing for him. He had never experienced this before. In his house, all they discussed ever was just Torah. His daughter, the sister of our Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1995, published a memoir called The Soloveitchik Heritage. It's about her parents, the parents of our Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is our Rabbi Soloveitchik's younger sister. And she tells us at the beginning of the book that shortly after their marriage, her father, Reb Moshe, was so upset that he picked himself up and he went back to Brisk. Oh my God, what did I do? This is not my world. And she writes that the couple was separated for a number of months until finally her father was prevailed upon to return back to his young wife, and thank God they lived a happy life together. It took years, but he finally was able to appreciate his wife's position and recognize the importance of worldly culture. The story is significant and the background is significant because it gives us a sense of the world into which our Rabbi Soloveitchik was born. His parents represented both the world of Torah only, the father, the world of Torah and the mother. Both of these were to figure very prominently in the unfolding of the life and thought of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I will analyze Torah only in the next unit, in Unit 2. I will analyze Torah and in the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the following unit, in Unit 3. Their oldest child, named Joseph Dov, Yosef Ber, known by his Yiddish name Beryl, was born in Prusjin on February 27, 1903. We know that the family was very poor. We don't know a lot more about the family, but we do have one experience that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about many years ago that is extremely important and predictive of how his life would unfold. I'd like you to turn, please, to source one. Before we examine the text, I want to introduce now what will be a common feature in all of my presentations, and that is, wherever possible, having Rabbi Soloveitchik speak for himself. Rather than me trying to describe or summarize Rabbi Soloveitchik, I feel very strongly that no one can better present Rabbi Soloveitchik, then Rabbi Soloveitchik himself. He drafted the essay in which this appeared. The title is, "And From There You Shall Seek." In the 1940s, for various reasons, it did not appear in print in Hebrew until 1978. I remember when I was growing up, I was a frightened and lonely boy. We are going to see that Rabbi Soloveitchik was remarkably and unusually self-revelatory. He talked about himself and about his personal experiences. And he tells us that when he was a little boy, growing up, he was frightened and lonely. "I was afraid of the world. For me, the world was a cold and strange place. I imagined that everyone was mocking me. But I had one friend, do not laugh at me. It was the Rambam, Maimonides. How did we become friends? Simply, we met. Maimonides was a constant guest in our home. During the days when my father was a newlywed, supported by my grandfather, the pious Gaon, the great scholar, Rabbi Elijah Feinstein of Prujana, father studied Torah day and night. A small group of outstanding young scholars gathered around him and eagerly absorbed his teachings. My father studied with his disciples in the room where my bed was located." So this is not a fancy house with multiple rooms, with a study room and a bedroom and another bedroom and a garage. This is a very tiny, modest little home. He has a bed in a room where there's a table and a couple of chairs. So he's on the bed, he's trying to fall asleep. He's a little boy, can't really fall asleep because his father is sitting in the room teaching Torah to a couple of students who were gathered around. "My want was to sit on my bed and listen to my father's words. What else was he going to do? He couldn't go to sleep. He constantly quoted Maimonides. His method was," and then Rabbi Soloveitchik explains, he opened up a passage in the Talmud, analyzed the Talmud, and then said, "Well, how does Maimonides understand this Talmudic text?" And sometimes there was problems because it was difficult to understand Maimonides. It was complicated. And he's trying to work on it and to figure it out, and the students are sitting around and he's working on it, the father. And finally he says, "Oh, wow, great. I found an answer." Once again, to skip a paragraph, he would exclaim that the words of Maimonides were incomprehensible. Nevertheless, he wouldn't give up. He put his hand on his head. He was engrossed in deep thought. The students would not disturb his thought process. Finally, he would lift his head and begin to expound the true meaning of Maimonides. "I would strain my ears to catch my father's every word. In my young and impressionable mind, there developed a dual impression. First, that Maimonides was being attacked by enemies who wanted to hurt him. And second, that the Rambam's, Maimonides' only defender was my father. I felt strongly as a little boy, I felt strongly that without my father, who knows what would happen to Maimonides? It was as if Maimonides himself were with us in the room, listening to my father's words. The Rambam sat next to me on my bed. What did he look like? I don't know exactly. He seemed to look like an exceedingly handsome and good father. His name was also Moshe, just like my father." This is a remarkable window into the experience of a little boy. "Intensely following my father, the students absorbed his every word. Slowly but surely, the tension evaporated. My father continued his discourse with strength, with courage, new ideas. Everything is working out. It's all great. Maimonides emerged triumphant. My father's face was filled with happiness and delight. He had defended his friend Maimonides. The Rambam was comforted and smiled. I too was delighted and joined in the feeling of joy in the room. I would jump from my bed and run to my mother." Mother, extremely important for Rabbi Soloveitchik. The world knows about his relationship with his father. His relationship with his mother was intensely profound. And here's a window, a little boy. As soon as his father figured out how to interpret Maimonides, he jumps out of bed, he runs to his mother, and he says, cries out with the good news, "Mother, mother, the Rambam won, Maimonides won. He beat those who were disagreeing with him. Father helped him. Look how wonderful my father is." But once in a while, my father did not succeed. And despite all of his efforts, the enemies of the Rambam defeated him. Their questions were as strong as iron. Although my father mustered all his strength, he couldn't save the Rambam from his detractors. Salvation did not come. Deep in thought, my father would lean his head on the palms of his hand on the table. The students and I, and even the Rambam, waited in great tension for my father's words. But he would raise his head, and he said sadly, "There is no answer. It's too difficult." The shiur, the lecture, the presentation ended with no explanation. The students were sad, and even my father was depressed. A sense of despair descended upon all of us. I cried. Even the eyes of the Rambam glistened with teardrops. With a broken heart, I would walk slowly to my mother and cry out to her, "Mother, father can't answer the Rambam. What are we going to do? He didn't succeed today." And my mother would tell me, "So profound. Don't worry. Father will find an answer to the Rambam. And if he does not succeed, then when you grow up, perhaps you will find an answer to the Rambam." This window into the very early life of Rabbi Soloveitchik is so powerful for a number of reasons. Number one, it highlights the encompassing centrality of Torah study. We'll come back to this in Unit 2. Father studied Torah day and night. Number two, it highlights the centrality of Maimonides in that effort. He constantly quoted Maimonides. We're going to come back to this repeatedly throughout this entire seminar. And number three, the powerful role his mother played in his life. Could you imagine a little boy? He's crying. He's distraught. His father, his hero, failed. And his mother says, "You know what? You're going to be able to do it. You could do, I am telling you, I'm your mother, and I'm telling you that you're going to be able to do what even your father was not able to do." Such an empowering faith that she had in him that was so important.
As a young man, 22, 23 years old, Rabbi Soloveitchik goes to Berlin to study philosophy. Why? Why choose philosophy?
So there are two questions. One question is, why did he go to Berlin to study anything? And the second question is, if he's going to Berlin already to university, why study philosophy? And I think the answer to both of those iterations of your question is the same. Primarily, Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother understood that in order for a young man to have an impact in the world as a Jewish leader, it was important for that young man to be exposed to the broader world of contemporary Western culture. The father was not on board originally, but the father became on board. And under the influence primarily of his mother, he was already previously exposed a little bit to the world of surrounding culture, and then made a huge commitment to leave his parental home and the only society to which he had been accustomed for the first 20 plus years of his life, and to go to a foreign, strange environment, because he understood, as his mother taught him, that for him to have an impact, he needs to be exposed. And so his interest in general culture was not music or poetry. He felt, and I think correctly so, that he would be able to have the greatest impact as a budding and future Jewish leader if he would expose himself particularly to the world of philosophy. This was the coin of intellectual sophistication in the general culture and also particularly in Jewish culture. He did not want to have an influence in the strictly defined confines of the yeshiva. He wanted to have an influence on the broader Jewish community, the yeshiva and beyond. And for him, a combination of the first 20 plus years plus a rigorous exposure to philosophy, hearing his mother's values in his head, I believe is what motivated him to go and to land particularly in the faculty of philosophy at the University of Berlin.
Young Joseph Baer lived in Prujin until 1910, and then he moved with his family to two different towns in White Russia, where his father got positions as a rabbi. During that time, he studied intensely with his father. His father assumed responsibility for his Talmudic education, and he was also, a little bit, exposed to the works of Ibsen and Pushkin and Lermontov and Bialik, giants of both Russian and Hebrew literature, by his mother. 1920, they moved to Warsaw. He continues his Talmudic studies, and he also continues his exposure to secular studies in a systematic fashion, and he studies in Warsaw's Free Polish University, studies political science for three semesters. And then a major move. In the fall of 1926, the age of 23, he leaves Warsaw to study philosophy at the University of Berlin. It is impossible to overstate the significance of this transition for him from the Torah-centered traditional culture of his childhood and family tradition to the secular metropolis of this massive city called Berlin. Imagine for a moment what it personally must have felt like for this young man, he's 23 years old, to leave the familiar environment of his family, to leave a life revolving almost exclusively around an intense focus on full-time, high-level Torah study, and move to a foreign and alien culture. He knew no one in Berlin, one governed by very different values. He once told a student, and I quote, "You have no idea how enormously difficult it was for me to move from the world of Reb Chaim to that of Berlin University." We can only imagine how challenging it must have been for him on those long, lonely winter nights in a foreign city, foreign language, foreign culture, surrounded by what was alien to him. We don't know much, but an insight is forthcoming from a very interesting and unexpected source. In 1994, a book of memoirs was privately published by somebody by the name of Werner Silberstein, a German Jew who had known and met Rabbi Soloveitchik in Berlin, and he tells us the following story. Please turn to source two. This is privately published. Somebody sent it to me a couple of years ago, and I read it, and it's fascinating. So, Werner Silberstein, I wish I knew more about him, I don't know anything about him, writes the following, source two. "In the 20s, I became acquainted with Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, a young man who just arrived in Berlin from Warsaw, where his father was the principal of a school, and he came to study philosophy at Berlin University." And he tells us in the first paragraph that the Rabbi Soloveitchik walked into the synagogue on a Friday evening. He stands in the back, a 23-year-old fellow, and everybody starts to talk. "You know who that is? You know who that is? That's the grandson of Reb Chaim. He's in the back. He's in the back." They knew he was coming. They knew he was there. Somehow they recognized him. It was a big deal. It's a big, big talk that he's now in the back in our synagogue. Paragraph three, "It didn't take long for us to become well acquainted and then good friends. He often came to our house in Berlin, one of the few he was able to eat without hesitation, even on Passover." Where's he going to eat? How does he know that he could trust the level of kashrut in a particular home? "In this connection, I should like to relate an unforgettable episode." Gives us again a window into the person. I want to get in touch with the person. We can't separate the person from the thought. If you ask me to draw a picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik, I once took a Rorschach exam when I was a little boy. I went to a psychologist, and the psychologist said, "Draw a picture of yourself." So obviously, what one draws is very telling. If I were to draw a picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik, I would draw like a huge circle, like one big, giant, massive head, and then he had an arm, and he had another arm, and he had a leg, but it was like all brain. So I want to move away from that image. I want to move to the heart part to the human part of Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. We're going to spend a lot of time in that big circle, but let's try to become a little bit sensitive to the human. So here's the story. It's Passover. He wrote often, spoke and then wrote often, about the Passover seders that he had with his grandfather, Reb Chaim, with such passion and drama and interest and excitement. Could you imagine what's going on at that Passover seder, the intensity of the level of Torah scholarship, the punctilious observance of every single act? And now he's all by himself. He tells us that when he left his parents to come to Berlin, and I'm almost quoting, "I did not know if I would ever see them again." He's all by himself. It's Passover. Where's he going to go? What's he going to do? And what's it going to look like and feel like for him? So he lands in the Silberstein household. In this connection, I would like to relate an unforgettable episode. It sure is unforgettable. During a visit a few days before Passover, he replied to my wife Raya's invitation that he be our guest on Seder night. "Great, but could I be present when you kosher the cooking stove?" So that's like a little bit, I don't know how to describe it, but you know, I don't know if I could really eat here because I don't know what you do in this house. So his wife, Raya, is a very wonderful woman. "And with pleasure," she says. And then she adds, "but with the request that you tell me quite honestly if something is not done correctly. I do it the way I learned from my bubby, from my grandma. So that's what I do. If you think that it's not good and you're not comfortable and I want you to be comfortable, so I'll do anything that I need to do for you." Joseph Dove came at the appointed time for koshering the stove. So I would recommend, or maybe not, if you're invited to somebody's house, you say, "I'm really happy to come, but I want to be there in the kitchen when you prepare. I want to watch everything that you do." He showed up. After a while, he disappeared suddenly. "Oi," said Raya, "I've obviously failed the test." But lo and behold, a little later, a magnificent bunch of flowers arrived in acceptance of our invitation to participate in our Seder. At the university, Rabbi Soloveitchik took his studies of philosophy very seriously. But at the same time, don't think for a moment, at the same time, the study of Torah remained most central for him. Rabbi Soloveitchik's son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, in 2001, published a large volume, which includes a number of advanced Torah essays that Rabbi Soloveitchik sent to his father, Rav Moshe, an old study partner, dealing with issues relating to Talmudic thought, and in particular, focusing on the code of law written by his old childhood friend, Maimonides. On July 24, 1930, he was orally examined by his doctoral advisors. We'll come back to that in a moment. And in the fall of 1930, he moved to Vilna to court and to marry his wife, Tanya Levitt. He met her in Berlin. She was studying for and received a doctorate in education from the University of Jena, which is about an hour outside of Berlin. She went back to Vilna. He's in love with her. He picks up AWOL from the University of Berlin. He's going after this woman. He moves for a year almost to Vilna to court her, and they were married in Vilna in June of 1931. Turn to source 3. This is their wedding invitation. It's a little card. I have a little card. It's a little card. This is the text. The card is maybe 1.5 times the size of the text that you have in source 3. And it says, "Tanya Levitt, Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, invite his honorable one, i.e. you, to participate in the celebration of their marriage, which will take place with the will of God on Tuesday, June 16th, 1931, here is in Vilna," and they give you the address of where the wedding is going to take place. So this is different than the standard wedding invitations that we may be familiar with. It's not Mr. and Mrs. this and Mr. and Mrs. that invite you to participate in the wedding of their children. The two of them made a wedding. She and he send out an invitation, a little card, come to our wedding. And they get married, as we know, on June 16th, 1931. A few months later in the fall, they come back to Berlin. Rabbi Soloveitchik finished work on his doctoral dissertation. He was awarded his diploma at the end of the following year, the end of 1932. There is a file today sitting in the archives of the University of Berlin that contains much information about Rabbi Soloveitchik's stay in that institution. Source number 4 is a little biographical description that he wrote. This is the exact copy of the exact text that is in that file. It's an English translation at the bottom, gives a little bit of a background, thanks his doctoral professors. In particular, he thanks Dr. Meyer and Dr. Deswar. In the file, source number 5, is the report of his oral exam. And it's in German, everything is in German. He's taught in German, he learns German, he's writing German, he lives in the world of German, it's Berlin in 1930s. And the first, you see the date, July 24th, 1930, Joseph Soloveitchik, the Polish spelling of Soloveitchik. He passed with laudable, so it's probably good, laudable. And the first one is Deswar. You see that it says gut with a line, Deswar, that was one professor. The bottom one is Meyer, sehr gut. So one gave him a gut, which means good. One gave him a sehr gut, which means very good. And he passed in July of 1930. To the right, there is a letter in the file, source number 6, requesting an extension of the deadline to complete his dissertation. He's writing from Vilna, and he says, we know why he's in Vilna, because he wants to marry this woman who picked up and went to Vilna. He's in Vilna and he writes that due to various considerations, I'm not able to finish my dissertation, but I'm gonna do it, I'm committed, it's gonna be okay, please have a little bit of patience. It's to the philosophical faculty at the Friedrich Wilhelm University, that's what it was called, in Berlin. I was there not long ago, it used to be in what was known as East Berlin. Now it's all big one Berlin, you can go and visit. And that's what it used to be called, now it's called the University of Berlin. And he writes requesting an extension on his dissertation completion. Source number 7 is his actual diploma. His diploma is in the file. The diploma is about 10 times as large as what you have here in source 7. It's about 2 feet by 1 foot, and I reduced it and reduced it and reduced it and reduced it. We have it here in front of you. You see the date, a couple of lines from the bottom, the 10th of December, 1932. And on the right side is the cover page of his doctoral dissertation that was submitted. And you see at the bottom, you see his name, the way he spells his name, still Polish. And the date of his exam was 24 July 1930. The date that he received his doctorate, that he was awarded his doctorate, was December 10, 1932.
Shortly before he finishes his doctoral work at the University of Berlin, Rabbi Soloveitchik and his new wife and young daughter leave Europe for America. Why did they do that?
I think there are two answers. For me, the first answer would be his parents were in America. He had a very intensely close relationship, particularly with his father. I know less about his relationship personal with his mother, but he does write and did speak about his close relationship with her and the enormous influence that she had on him. He's a young man, just got married, has, I think, a 3-month-old little girl. He wants to be reunited with his parents. I understand that. It was very important to him. We sometimes lose sight of the fact that great geniuses are also people, and people have feelings, and we need to respect that and appreciate that. Second of all, I think it was his considered assessment that he would be able to flourish most profoundly and most effectively as a Jewish leader in the full range of what that means in the United States of America at that time. I don't know what he knew about the United States deeply beforehand, but he felt, I think, that this was where his talents would best develop. He went to the United States because he had received an invitation from a school in Chicago to come to move to Chicago to teach Talmud in that institution. So there was a direct reason why he came to the United States. But I think it fit with these other two considerations. The United States was open territory. The United States was not yet mined for its potential Jewish development. And he thought he could get in and make a difference, and history only proves that that's exactly what happened.
By December 10, 1932, Rabbi Soloveitchik's parents were already living in New York. They arrived in New York at the end of the summer of 1929. His father had accepted an invitation to teach Talmud at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary in New York City. By December 10, 1932, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself was also in the United States. Previous summer, he and his wife and five-month-old daughter set out for the United States. They arrived at the end of August, and shortly after his arrival, he was elected chief rabbi of Boston. In fact, in the file appended to his diploma is a letter that he sent them apologizing. "I'm really sorry I can't come in person to pick up the diploma. You see, I'm in the United States now. Maybe someday I'll come." Came by boat. We know exactly the boat. We have the manifest of the boat that he took to come to the United States. It was a big deal to come to the United States from Europe. It's now 1932. I apologize. Hold on to it. Someday I'm coming back. It's still there, the full diploma in the original. He becomes the chief rabbi of Boston. Source number 9. This is the cover of the local Jewish newspaper in Boston, the Boston Jewish Advocate. "Dr. Soloveitchik installed at Temple Beth El as head of 11 United Orthodox congregations in Boston." And he's referred to as Dr. Soloveitchik. Like right under the wire, he became Dr. Soloveitchik on December 10, 1932. Till then, he was Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now it's Rabbi Dr. Soloveitchik. Just in time, he's presented to the Boston community. It doesn't say Rabbi Soloveitchik. It says Dr. Soloveitchik is installed at Temple Beth El as the head of 11 United Orthodox congregations in Boston. Rabbi Soloveitchik immediately immerses himself in many different efforts in Boston to raise the standards of both Jewish education and also the supervision of kashrut, of kosher food, maintaining the integrity of kosher food in that city. Shortly after he arrived, he founded an organization that was designed to improve the quality of the supplementary Hebrew school group of institutions in Boston. He also founded two schools, one in 1937, together with his wife, who played a very, very significant role until she passed away in this school. Founded a day school, and you can guess the name of the day school because he named it after his childhood friend who sat next to him on the bed, who alternatively smiled or cried based on how successful his father was in defending him. The school is named the Maimonides School, and he founded another school, an advanced Talmudic academy that was modeled after classic East European yeshivot, East European Talmudic academies, called for the name of his grandfather. It was known as Heichal, the institution, the school of Rabbi Chaim Halevi. Maimonides School still stands. It's still up and running. It's a great school. The days of the Heichal were numbered because as soon as Rabbi Soloveitchik succeeded his father in New York, the school closed in around 1941. There's one event that I just want to mention now because I want to come back to it later that occurred during this time, and that is that in 1935, Rabbi Soloveitchik tried out for the position of Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. And I want to hold off that story till we come to his an analysis of his attitude towards Zionism and to the State of Israel in Unit Number 6. On January 31st, 1941, his father died unexpectedly. And the question of who would succeed his father as the head Talmud teacher at the Rabbi Isaac Hochanan Theological Seminary was a complicated one. And after a struggle, Rabbi Soloveitchik was invited to succeed him. To give you a sense of the complexity, turn to source number 10. This is the cover of the undergraduate newspaper of the students at Yeshiva College. You see, it's called The Commentator, published by students of Yeshiva College. You see the date, April 2nd, 1941. Big headlines. Dr. Herzog, who was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, is coming to visit Yeshiva. It's 1941. There's things are happening in the world now in 1941. There are things happening in the Jewish world in 1941. The chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, of the land of Israel, is coming to Yeshiva. Big headlines. And if you look at the bottom in the middle, tiny, 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 four rabbis invited to join the faculty here. This is April of 1941. His father died in January of 1941. At the last meeting of the board of directors held on Thursday, it was voted to extend invitations to four of the outstanding scholars of present-day Jewry to become members of the faculty of Yeshiva. First one is a Rabbi Rubinstein. The second one is a Rabbi Dr. Chaim Heller. The third one is a Rabbi Rosen. And the fourth of four, tucked away, all the way, bottom of the page, tiny print, and Rabbi J.B. Soloveitchik of Boston and son of the late Rabbi Moses Soloveitchik of sainted memory. A lot of tension about Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik following his father. He was given a one-year contract by the board of directors of Rabbi Isaac Hochanan Theological Seminary, and as we say, the rest is history. By then, in the 10 years or so since he had come to the United States, Rabbi Soloveitchik had already earned some degree of national exposure. And that only began to grow as he now had an opportunity to turn his attention away from the specifics of the Boston Jewish community to the much broader canvas of the totality of America's Orthodox community and general Jewish community. He began to write and publish very important essays. Halachic Man, we'll come back to that. The Halachic Mind, we'll come back to that. From There You Shall Seek, I already made reference to it before. All of them were written in the mid-1940s. And I will analyze them as we will unfold our analysis, our discussion, particularly in units 4 and 5. In his capacity as teacher of Talmud at the Rabbi Isaac Hochanan Theological Seminary, Rabbi Soloveitchik became the spiritual mentor of the majority of American-trained Orthodox rabbis. He ordained over 2,000 rabbis, ordaining more rabbis than anyone ever in the totality of Jewish history. The reason why my father, to come back to my father, had a close connection, one of the reasons, was because my father was the first of the 2,000-plus ordainees of Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik. When my father studied with his father at Rabbi Isaac Hochanan Theological Seminary, his father died suddenly. My father was with a couple other guys that were, oh my God, what are we gonna do? He was ready to take his exam. When the dust settled, Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik showed up. They lined up at the door. My father was the first one in, the first one to get rabbinic ordination from Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik, and that is something that in our family is very special and sort of bound me to Rabbi Soloveitchik in a very interesting way. He knew of that connection and he had, if I may say, a great deal of respect for my father as well. After a couple of years, Rabbi Soloveitchik was appointed the honorary president of the Religious Zionists of America, the chairman of the Halacha Jewish Law Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America, two positions that made it possible for him to exert an enormous influence on the organizational life, not just of American modern Orthodoxy, but of the American Jewish community and beyond. And I will particularly examine that influence in units number 7 and 8. In 1984, Rabbi Soloveitchik fell ill and he withdrew from public life. His wife died in 1967. He sustained a triple loss in the spring of 67. His wife, his mother, and his brother all died within a few months. It was a hugely traumatic experience for him that he wrote about, spoke about, and that we will come back to. And he passed away in the intermediate days of Passover in 1993. There is a picture of his tombstone next to that of his wife on Source 11 in the Baker Street Cemetery in the West Roxbury section outside of Boston. Rabbi Soloveitchik was one of the 20th century's most influential figures, generally, certainly within the Jewish community, and certainly within the Orthodox Jewish community. And his teachings continue to reverberate in many different circles, both within and without the Orthodox community, and in a variety of non-Jewish circles, both religious and secular. The core focus of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life and teachings was the centrality of halacha, or Jewish law, and the love and the study of Torah. Both practically, he spent more time on this endeavor throughout his life than on anything else, and also axiologically. Nothing else in the world rivaled it for the value that it had in his worldview. And it is to this particular aspect of his teaching, what I'm going to be calling Torah only, that I will return my attention to first in the next presentation. Thank you.
You described in this lecture how long, how many hours, how tenderly, how lovingly Rabbi Soloveitchik studied with his father. For some of our viewers, I would just like you to explain, what does it mean to study Torah so rigorously? What does that look like? What is that?
Torah is a gift. Torah is multifaceted. Torah begins with the Bible, and then with the prophets, and with what we call Holy Scripture. But Torah, as it is studied intensely, is the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, which is a collection of wisdom and thoughts and ideas and perspectives that have spanned many generations and many centuries. The Babylonian Talmud is complex. There are no vowels in the Babylonian Talmud. There is no punctuation in the Babylonian Talmud. Every word runs into every other word. Some of it is in Hebrew, some of it is in Aramaic. The simple translation is difficult. For sure, how one section follows the other is hard to determine. It's even hard to determine when one section ends and another one begins. There are no visual aids. Just like in the classic Torah scroll, it's just one run-on sentence. And that's why when one reads the Torah, one is actually a master, because one must know in advance how to read each word and where each sentence ends. And so this literature is complicated. But it's majestic, and it's exalted, and it's amazing, and it has so much depth and wisdom. And so one can spend a lifetime working through the Talmudic text. Not very long ago, I joined what is known as Daf Yomi, one folio a day. It takes about 7.5 years to finish. One a day is asking too much, because it's very hard. And an hour and a half, it's difficult to master. But because Rabbi Soloveitchik believed, having been taught this by his father and under the influence of both of his grandparents and his mother, that this is a divinely inspired text, that this is a representation of God's word, God's thinking. God didn't write it, but God inspired it. So it's a holy text, and my life is guided by this text, and I want to understand this text. I'm fascinated by this text. So I believe I heard him once say, Rabbi Soloveitchik, that for 10 years, he studied 10 hours a day Talmud with his father. That is just shockingly mind-blowing. Just imagine 10 hours a day. And I remember he described, well, they used to go to the synagogue to study. They were the only two ones, the only two there. It was quiet. And in the winter, they had to huddle next to the oven because it was cold in Russia in the wintertime. So imagine the father and the son. So he's 10, 12, 14, sitting there day after day and mastering one tractate, one book of the Talmud after another. And this speaks to an incredible relationship between father and son, and between the tradition that they studied together and the young boy whose mind and whose heart and whose life was being shaped by that tradition.
In the world of traditional Torah scholarship, Maimonides is a contested figure, with some of his work being celebrated and honored and studied very carefully, some of his work looked at with a little more skepticism. How did Rabbi Soloveitchik receive Maimonides from his father, and what role did it play in his later rabbinic writing and career?
There's a great deal of discussion in the world of Maimonides' studies. A discussion that began already shortly after his passing. There were those shortly after he died who went so far as to ban the guide and live only in the world of the code. They perceived of Maimonides solely and wholly, wholly, in the world of halakha, in the world of Jewish law, and were so upset by his philosophical works that they actually put them under the ban. They never put him under the ban. He was considered to be too great. In the scholarly literature, it's known as the heroic image of Maimonides. But they did not have a problem. They didn't hesitate to put some of his works in under the ban. Later on, there were those who argued that the Guide for the Perplexed was actually not written by Maimonides. It's a pseudepigraphic work, which means that it was written by somebody else who put Maimonides' name on it. It is actually inconceivable for them that the author of the Code of Jewish Law, which is so clearly based in traditional Jewish thinking and practice and behavior, could ever have written this kind of a open, philosophical, conceptual analysis. And must be that somebody else wrote it. Today, we wouldn't do that. Today, the notion of pseudepigrapha is just unheard of. If I write a book, I want my name on the book. In medieval times, it was more important for authors to have their book read than to have their name on their book. So they would write a book, and there's a whole history of this, and put somebody else's name on, who's a great person. Why would they read his book? They're going to read the great Maimonides, so people are going to read it thinking that Maimonides wrote it, and for them that was good enough. So the contested legacy of Maimonides is something that is part of the history of Maimonidean studies since Maimonides himself. And I would say that Rabbi Soloveitchik, having been influenced by Maimonides, I think followed the chronological trajectory of the rhythm to which he was influenced by Maimonides. He was first influenced and was first exposed to Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah. His first exposure was as a little boy sitting in the room. His father was teaching, not the Guide for the Perplexed. I wonder whether his father really ever worked through the Guide for the Perplexed. His grandfather, his father's father, who we also had an opportunity to introduce, I can't imagine ever read the Guide for the Perplexed. He lived fully in the Maimonides of the Mishneh Torah, in the halachic Maimonides. And that was Rabbi Soloveitchik's first exposure, and I think ultimately his most sustained exposure to Maimonides. And Maimonides for him was a model of rigor and careful formulation. I once heard Rabbi Soloveitchik say that when I was studying with my father, and we saw that he studied a great deal as a young boy with his father. When I was studying with my father, if I could say it in three words, and I said it in four words, he would slap me. Leaving aside the slap me, clearly, for him, the notion of absolute rigor and precision of formulation was something that he imbibed deeply as a child and was the hallmark of his life's work, both oral and written. That was modeled by Maimonides himself. So we have a commitment to and a living in the world of halacha. We have an appreciation of, and actually more than an appreciation of, a demand for radical precision. And then later on in life, as he himself developed a broader interest in Jewish thought, writ large, including philosophy, clearly for Rabbi Soloveitchik, Maimonides played a role not only in the world of what I call Torah only, but also in the world of what I call Torah and. Maimonides was a very important figure for him. He named a school that he founded in Boston, Maimonides, and it's not a coincidence.